From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on February 24th, when the former Deputy Secretary for Economic Development and Special Advisor to the Governor of New York State published her account of Governor Andrew Cuomo's sexual harassment. Alleged sexual harassment, we should say. And it included an allegation that could be even be considered assault. Lindsay Boylan rose through the ranks of New York State's Economic Development Office, and she hoped she was making those strides based on her talent and her performance. But it became clear to her that Governor Andrew Cuomo was sexually interested in her. The governor's own staff hinted at this to Boylan. And after many instances in which Boylan says the governor made her feel uncomfortable or demeaned, it culminated with, she says, the governor standing in front of her and kissing her on the lips against her will. Governor Cuomo has denied that allegation, but he has acknowledged that he made many women feel uncomfortable with his behavior at work. When Boylan's allegation came out, she feared that it would result in a smear campaign from the governor's office. And in a sense, she was right. After she published her account, the governor's team released her personnel records in an attempt to discredit her, according to the New York Times. The Times also reports that the governor's staff drafted a letter meant to be sent to former staff members, hoping they would side with the governor. They ultimately did not send the letter, but the governor's top staff called women who used to work in Albany trying to ascertain their position on Boylan's essay. One of those women was Anna Liss, who now serves as the director of planning and development for Monroe County. Liss worked in Albany during the Cuomo administration, but privately had felt demeaned by the experience. She recently came forward publicly to support Lindsay Boylan and to join the growing group of women who said that Cuomo and his team made life miserable for many women. They felt constantly sexualized. They felt less respected than the men in the office. Liss has extensive educational and work experience, but often felt that her talent was not appreciated by Cuomo and the staff. When Anna Liss came forward, she worried it would jeopardize her own career. But as she has explained, she wants to see the culture of power change. She wants to see women respected for their skills and talent and experience and education, not just told to wear high heels when the governor's around. She hopes her story can make a difference. My guest is the Director of Planning and Development for Monroe County. Anna Liss, welcome back to Connections.
Thank you, Evan.
What went through your mind when you read Lindsay Boylan's essay on February 24th?
I believed every word. I even had observed some of that dynamic when I was there, when she and I were colleagues. However, I thought to myself, wow, how tremendously courageous. They're going to try and take you down. They'll do everything that they can to discredit you, which they did attempt to do, as you referenced.
Yeah, and part of what the New York Times described was a series of phone calls from some of the governor's top staff, including people like Rich Azzopardi, a top aide to the governor, to different women who have worked or work for the governor, trying to ascertain what was your experience, where are you at on that. You got one of those calls. Can you tell us about it?
Yes. Lindsay first alluded to her allegations in a tweet in December. This was several weeks before she published that blog post. Approximately a week after she tweeted the allegation, Rich Azzopardi called me. It was a Monday morning, and I thought to myself, wow, the governor's office is reaching out. I wonder if this is work-related. Perhaps they're calling to ask me about some economic development projects. And instead, Mr. Azzopardi his voice sounded a little awkward, and he asked me pointedly, if Lindsay Boylan had reached out to me, if I had spoken with her, if I had an existing relationship with her, and asked me to let him know if she did indeed reach out to talk about her allegations against the governor.
And all of this is being investigated right now. And part of the reason we've invited Anna Liss on this program is, number one, we think she deserves the space to tell this story, and this is the first time on Connections of doing so. But also, we will get to maybe understanding the differences in the investigations that are trying to track a lot of this, and why many people, including Anna Liss, don't view those investigations as sort of equally viable or valuable. So before we get back to that, how did you interpret Rich Azzopardi's phone call?
I interpreted it as a form of intimidation, and I immediately thought, I wonder who else they're calling. They must be calling a lot of people if I was on their list. And I also thought, wow, they must have observed some of the things that I experienced.
Hmm. How much concern do you have of what the governor can do to people's career? I mean, you mentioned your concern for Lindsay. I do imagine that speaking publicly at all has to bring some anxiety to yourself. How much concern do you have of what the governor's been able to do?
I'm very afraid. He is the most powerful man in New York State, one of the most powerful Democrats in the whole country, at least up until quite recently. And I never would have dreamed of opening my mouth had the other women who stepped forward, especially Lindsay, not displayed such courage. I wanted to chime in to show my support. And my boss, County Executive Adam Bellow, expressed to me that he had my back 100%, and I had nothing to fear here in my current job, and I felt empowered in that moment. But I'm still nervous, and I am getting a lot of harassing tweets and emails directed at me, and people sending me unsolicited nasty messages. But I'm standing my ground.
Well, and I'll just say, as someone who has known you for a little while and known the work that you do and interacted with you on this program based on your expertise, you have the qualifications to do whatever you want in government. I mean, I take the point that you feel that it's probably really validating to get backing from a county executive. There's a part of me that hopes, eventually we'll have a world where you won't need that will sort of be expected. Right now, it's sort of not. Were you surprised to get that backing from the county executive?
I was, yeah. I mean, I shouldn't say that I was, because he's a very good and considerate man and boss and supportive no matter what. But yes, because of the political environment and the connections with the governor, and also from a governing standpoint, the county government relies on state funding and state support. And our governor has been known to be retaliatory, not only in his own workplace, but in politics, withholding support and funding in certain communities where he has disagreements with certain politicians, notably former mayor Stephanie Miner from Syracuse, mm-hmm. Who experienced the same. So I was concerned in that regard. Am I jeopardizing my boss's ability to do his job?
Sure. I want to ask you to let listeners know as much or as little as you prefer, just about that experience that made you decide to come forward, because you have mentioned it in other interviews that, your experience wasn't exactly the same as Lindsay, but everyone's experience is slightly different. There are hallmarks of similarity to these accounts. But for you, I wanted to give you some space to just describe for listeners a little bit about why you decided to come forward.
Sure. I was in my mid-20s when I was awarded the Empire State Fellowship, which I felt was a prestigious honor. There were only about a dozen of us mid-career young professionals with master's degrees that were awarded a two-year fellowship to go work in state government, and I was assigned to the executive chamber. And I had a master's degree. I'd been working for Greater Rochester Enterprise. I had good experience, and I thought I was going to be able to make a positive difference, work on economic development programs. I moved myself from Rochester to Albany, which is a significant distance, and I didn't have any friends there, didn't really know anybody there. And I was surprised not long after I arrived and was working on economic development programs, especially the regional council program, I was quickly invited by a senior staff member to sit in a desk that was right within the governor's line of sight, which was a very different workplace environment than the desk where I'd been sitting across the hall, because the governor was there. Whenever he was in Albany, he would come over to my desk and say hello and kiss me on the cheek, and he'd ask me if I had a boyfriend. I was advised by another senior staff member that women had to wear high heels when the governor was in Albany, and I did observe that everybody working on that side of the office who was a female was very attractive, and we wore skirts and dresses, and the governor never asked me about my work, only about personal life or flirtatious comments. I felt quite isolated, and long story short, I started my mental health journey seeking therapy because I felt So I felt like such a nobody. And I was surrounded also. It wasn't just sexual harassment. It was screaming, name-calling, people losing their jobs at the drop of a hat just because the governor didn't like them. I heard words, you know, the word loser or zero were tossed around like it was nothing, and cursing and people screaming into the phone. I had a couple of secretaries run into my office area at one point crying because they'd been screamed at by another senior staff member. And the toxicity was really, I could feel it in my bones. And my family observed that things were not going well for me and were really concerned. And, you know, ultimately I got out. I did whatever I could to get a job anywhere but there. And I ended up going to work for Cornell University and then later was recruited back by my previous employer at GRE, Greater Rochester Enterprise, and finally got to come home. And my life has completely turned around since that point. And there were lots of different things that happened. I won't go into too much detail, but that's sort of long story short. The fellowship program was set up such that young people would be attracted to work for state service, and particularly for the governor, for his administration, and want to stay there past the 2 years. And in my case, and in the case of several others, we just escaped because of how toxic it was and hostile.
One of the journalists who has written extensively about the culture in Albany is Rebecca Traister, and she is a journalist and author whose works include the book Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. Her recent piece for New York Magazine was titled Abuse and Power, with the subheadline reading, quote, Andrew Cuomo's governorship has been defined by cruelty that disguised chronic mismanagement. Why was that celebrated for so long? Rebecca Traister, welcome to Connections. Thanks for making the time.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
I know you spoke to analysts for your article in New York Magazine, and you spoke to many people, especially many women who worked for this governor. How consistent were the stories that you heard?
Incredibly consistent, actually. It was one of the things that was striking. Often with a polarizing public figure, you know, you get so many different perspectives. But in fact, so many of the stories and details that Anna has just been describing here were ones that I heard about from women, so many women, dozens of women and men who worked around the governor, both for him and for his administration, and who worked adjacent to him, you know, who were in positions within the state, state agencies or government, who didn't work directly in the executive chamber, but who had dealings with Governor Cuomo.
If I could, I'd like to read a little bit from your piece in New York Magazine now. You write, quote, Cuomo was a bully, but for a while he was our bully. Over the course of the past year, however, as he took his show national as Governor COVID, the political dynamics of Cuomo's own state were shifting. Now the venal toxicity that has buttressed his career has, at least temporarily, been exposed for what it is. Though the multiple scandals erupting in Albany seem to toggle between sexualized harassment stories and evidence of mismanagement, what is emerging is, in fact, a single story that through years of ruthless tactics deployed both within his office and against anyone he perceived as an adversary, a critic, or competitor for authority, Cuomo has fostered a culture that supported harassment, cruelty, and deception. And while some have continued to defend Cuomo's commitment to creating the perception of strength and his mastery of brutalist political theater, his tough guy routine has, in fact, worked to obscure governing failures. It is precisely what has permitted Cuomo and his administration to spend a decade being both mean and bad at their jobs. As one former Cuomo staffer told me, the same attitude that emboldens you to target a 25-year-old also emboldens you to scrub a nursing home report, end quote. Rebecca, you told Ezra Klein of the New York Times on his podcast that this is the performance of power. Can this governor keep performing it now?
Well, the question of what, of course he can keep performing it. He's still the governor of New York State. I think that this is part of a very long process in this country of beginning to question old ideas and myths we have around the connection between abusive power tactics and good governance. And, you know, we have so over, not just with regard to Andrew Cuomo, but over centuries, cemented this sort of false relationship in our minds with a kind of brutality in politics, right? Toughness, yelling, screaming, throwing things. And there's a whole storyline that, we have imaginatively written around this kind of power, which is built on old white patriarchal norms in which there was only a very small subset of people who could hold power, right? And the way that they treated others was how we understood power to operate, you know? And that brutality could be associated with their authority. That's hard-knuckled politics. Why do we have this phrase, hard-knuckled politics? I write in my piece about how several weeks before my piece came out, there was a piece about Cuomo's bullying in the New York Times in which somebody explained it and as a kind of defense, saying you have to admit he's a master of brutalist political theater. And I just sat there and thought, what is brutalist political theater? You know, we've accepted these phrases and these ideas. You have to admit he's effective without really moving to the next step, which is saying, but actually, is he effective? That goes across. It's not just about Andrew Cuomo. Those are questions to be asked about all kinds of political leaders and business leaders for whom we've created a lot of space for them to be really every level from cruel and brutal in their tactics to, absolutely engaging in workplace misconduct. And all of it falls under this umbrella of that's just what happens. You know, that's just power working, but it doesn't have to be that way. And so part of the process of disconnecting these ideas of brutality and often it may involve harassment, discrimination, bias, objectification, bullying, all these different things that Anna is describing one aspect of. And of course, there are lots of other people who've worked for and with Cuomo who have other versions related of these stories. You know, disconnecting those behaviors from our idea of what it means to have political or public or professional power.
Yeah,
and wield it responsibly.
I'd like to ask both of you about something that's been on my mind after listening to Rebecca Traister on Ezra's podcast, Ezra Klein's podcast, and talking about this very issue. We had a conversation on this program with a neuroscientist named Dr. James Fallon, and he wrote a book called The Psychopath Inside, which was about his discovery of his own nonviolent psychopathy. Dr. Fallon needed brain scans for research he was doing, ended up using his own family scans, which he then discovered that he had all of the hallmark signs of a nonviolent psychopath. And he studied himself. He changed his behavior as an experiment. He wrote a book about himself. He studied the tendencies of people with psychopathy. And part of what he found was that a significant number of American CEOs and political leaders are likely people with psychopathy. He's not saying they are violent. He's saying they are indifferent to the feeling of others. They become dead set on results and bottom lines. And what they end up hearing throughout their lives is, boy, that person's a jerk, but they're good. And they know how to sell themselves. And I want to listen to just a little bit of what Dr. Fallon said about why people with psychopathy are only around 1% of the population. I'm not saying Andrew Cuomo is that. I'm certainly not. This is more general. But Dr. Fallon says they are much more likely to become a powerful executive than someone who does not have psychopathy. And he even found that throughout his life about himself.
I've always been asked to be like the chairman of a leader of something, always. And it's just a natural thing. If you have these traits, people want you to be a leader. And they've always had that sort of, I guess, curse. But it's a natural thing, and people follow it. So I can, BS my way into and out of almost anything. And that's one of the traits. But I can always kind of talk my way out of it because I never acted guilty. And that's what psychopaths have, that ability to never look guilty. They don't have, tells. They don't have any of the behavioral attributes of guilt.
Sure.
At all.
And so, Rebecca Traister, there's Dr. Fallon. I'm not saying this is Andrew Cuomo. I'm speaking generally here, but there's Dr. Fallon saying he was, throughout his life, given positions he didn't even think he deserved, and often it was because people thought he was exhibiting the traits of a leader. And it turned out part of that was because he didn't care about what anybody felt around him. What does that say about us?
Well, I can't speak to the brain science of this at all, but I can speak to the historic patterns that we've had in this country that we built our country's institutions around. Because he's talking about a certain subset of people with, particular physical or neurophysical characteristics who have been offered these kinds of opportunities. There's another set of pathways where a very narrow subset of Americans have historically been offered certain kinds of opportunities. And again, it goes toward to the fact that this country was built around a sort of white capitalist patriarchy, right? Where over generations, you have not just governments, but our legal system, our economy, built around one version of power, where power is primarily, and in the past, sometimes exclusively held by white men. And so there is a subset of people to whom opportunities, he's describing this thing, oh, people just offered me opportunities. I'm not saying that every white man in America has been offered those opportunities, and we know that's certainly not the case by a factor of millions. But where opportunities for power were being offered to one kind of person, a very narrow subset of people. And, you know, and that contributed to a very narrow view of who could have authority, who could be dominant in what kinds of ways. And those ways were pretty broad: economically dominant, politically politically dominant, socially dominant, sexually dominant. And that has created, I think, the commonality here, given that I don't know anything about the brain science, is that you have authority in the grip of a tiny percentage of the population. And what happens when that is the case? That creates structures where you have masses of people outside of authority and a small number of people with that kind of authority. And that makes authority very easy to abuse.
I want to ask Annalisa about this. And, you know, I think to some of Rebecca's readers of the piece about Governor Cuomo's administration, And the fact that, as I mentioned in that passage, there's a view now that what's been happening is not just mean, but not very good government, not very good governance. Anna, did you experience an administration that was deeply invested in policy and making lives better, or did you experience an administration that was behaving as essentially the performance of power and the trappings of power in government as opposed to looking for real solutions?
I'd say a great majority of it was just a show, and that was demoralizing to me as someone who was naive, thinking that I was in a fellowship where I would influence policy, and it was really just about PowerPoint presentations, big, thick state of the state, quote-unquote, policy books. There was somebody in Rebecca's piece that said it was like policy as paint by numbers or something, and that hit the nail right on the head for me. And coupled with the toxic masculinity in the environment, I knew that Albany wasn't right for me.
I'd love to speak to that for just a second, because what Anna describes, so there are a lot of questions. I think, you know, one of the struggles in trying to explain how this is actually bad governance comes when people say, oh, but, you know, he's not accused of anything that's like what Harvey Weinstein was accused of. There's nothing violent. There's nothing, right? There's no, although there actually have been women who have accused him of physical incursion, including one anonymous woman who's accused him of groping. But there is this kind of sense of like, oh, come on, it's old-fashioned behavior. That's the defense of some of the sexualized diminution that women are discussing. And then again, there's this classic for the other stuff, the bullying, the yelling, the abuse. There's the, oh, that's just hard-knuckled politics. That's just, you got to play hardball in Albany in politics. But one of the ways we need to think about the damage that this does and the kind of structural harm, how it actually doesn't go to good governance. Take somebody like Anna, who described to me her passion for her state, for her city, for good government and good governance. And think about the story that she tells about being driven out of that state's government. Right. Out of the executive chamber, needing to leave because she was in a mental health crisis. I heard versions of that from so many of my sources, people who came into the Cuomo administration because they were super passionate and optimistic about making legislative and policy change that would shape the lives of New Yorkers. And they were passionate about that from any number of angles. Some of them saw state government as a chance to model new policy ideas that could then be taken to a federal level. Others just wanted, like, were committed to making New York State a more equal, functional place with broader structural support for more New Yorkers. And a lot of those people who had those commitments to policy, when they entered an administration that, as one of them on a cited this line, treated policy as, you know, paint by numbers or filling in the blanks in order to back up the desire to do a TV event or make a trip. And that's what so many sources described to me. A lot of those people were driven out of the Cuomo administration and, in fact, were put off of the whole notion of state government. So think of over time, and again, this kind of behavior extends well beyond Andrew Cuomo, but is also particular to Andrew Cuomo. Think of the people driven out of a Cuomo administration who could have been doing work on policy, on legislative change, on figuring out innovative, smart, compassionate ways to permit more New Yorkers to thrive and live lives with dignity and access to health care and all the things that we need to be working on in this state, who not only left the Cuomo administration, but perhaps left government itself. Mm-hmm. That is not good governance. Mm. That is not taking advantage of the resources that you have. That is not work to make the state better. And that's just one of the results of this kind of thing. And you saw it around in the reporting, you know, from the end of 2017 on Me Too. One of the tolls of this kind of behavior, as it is normalized and built into the system, is that you lose swaths of people around Me Too and cases of sexual harassment. You lost so many women and some men from careers, from professions, who could have been major contributors and reshaped those professions. And that is a deep loss with material consequences for people who live in a state and whose lives are shaped by that state's government.
Well, and, you know, on that subject, on the way we expect or don't expect leaders to behave, you recently tweeted about this and you wrote, quote, "You can be a leader, an elected official, a person in power, and also be a principled professional who is kind and respectful toward others," end quote. And, you know, look, I should note here, it's, you know, maybe it's easier for me to cast aspersions. I've never been a CEO. I've never been a manager or a boss or an elected leader. So, you know, maybe it's easier for me to agree with this, but I very much do agree that we can elevate strength that is also competent and kind and compassionate. Do you see that? Are you optimistic that that can happen? Do you feel like doors are finally going to open for that with the courage of Lindsay Boylan and yourself and so many others here?
Yes, I am optimistic because I see women like Lindsay raising up a new generation of young women and young men. I think we're awakening to this, the culture that disproportionately hurts women and minorities and vulnerable populations in the workplace, and we're trying to fix that status quo that Rebecca talks about. However, it's going to take a long time.
Mm-hmm. A couple more points, and before I let Rebecca Traister go, and I'm grateful for her time, and then we're going to wrap the hour talking to Anna about her concern and maybe about the two very different probes that are going on and what maybe she wants the listeners to understand about how they are different. A couple of other points here. The New York Post reported this week that the governor called a female supporter darling this week. And this is an issue that always seems to divide people. I've had listeners over the years tell me that, boy, people are off the deep end. You can't call people sweetheart anymore. Can't call someone darling anymore or honey anymore. But my sense, Rebecca, my sense is this. If your grandparents call someone sweetheart, that's generally endearing. But if a powerful political figure calls a woman sweetheart, it is demeaning, and often it is intended to demean or to diminish someone's status. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. I think there's also an alarmism that gets raised. Wow, I guess I'm going to go to jail if I call someone honey. Nobody's putting anybody in jail for right? Like, Governor Cuomo is still the governor. Let's just point out, sometimes when we speak critically about things like diminishing language, it quickly gets blown up into this, wow, the mob's coming. No, we're just actually trying to have a critical conversation about how objectification and sexist and sometimes racist language works to diminish people and reinforce unequal power dynamics in workplaces and, you know, in all kinds of different contexts. Okay, so let's establish that. Nobody's sending anybody to jail for using nicknames. Okay, that's not what's at stake. What we are talking about is what does it mean within a workplace and within a public political context to not refer to your employees or your colleagues or your coworkers or other adults you meet in a professional political context, like a supporter, you know? What does it mean to not refer to them by their names, but rather by gendered diminutives, right? And Anna is actually somebody who gave voice to that because she described how Andrew Cuomo called her a series of nicknames that were not her name, which she was confused because in that same way that we're taught, like, oh, just, you know, hard-knuckled politics. And also, if somebody calls me a nice, you know, a nickname, it means they like me, right? And if that's your boss and your boss is the governor, there is a very strong temptation to think, well, it just means he's fond of me, right? But Anna gave voice to this other element of it, which is crucial to the conversation about workplace equity, which is, boy, what, as she said to me, and Anna, you can correct me if I'm getting this wrong, but what she said to me is, I actually really wanted him to know my name because I was there in a professional capacity. And what if, you know, I want to continue to work for my life as a professional, and I hope that the governor, who I worked very hard for, will remember what my actual name was. You know, there was, and that matters, right? It matters if the women in your office are being referred to as Sweetie or Honey or Sparky or Sponge, which is what another woman told me he used to call her, or whether they're being referred to professionally by their names, by their bosses and their peers. And this tactic of not knowing someone's name, I also want to say here, extends, in Cuomo's case, across contexts. That is something, it's a power move to not learn the names of your employees or your coworkers because it reinforces a message to them that you don't have to learn their names. One of the anecdotes in my piece that is a really disturbing one was actually told to me by a young man who worked for Cuomo in 2017, who described going to a party where his top aide, Melissa DeRosa, was being roasted at the governor's mansion. And it was all a big, all her colleagues, you know, an affectionate roast. And they showed the photos of state officials, heads of agencies, commissioners, prominent state officials. And the joke was, the roast was, does Melissa DeRosa, the governor's top aide, most senior aide, know the names of these important and presumably hardworking state officials? And the joke was she didn't know their names. And that is actually what prompted that young man to say to me, this isn't funny. This is you're bad at your job and you're mean. But that's clearly a power move. She didn't need to know the names of those people. And that is problematic and should be troubling to New Yorkers. And then there's another, and there are also employees who talk about how DeRosa, who told me about how DeRosa could yell at them via email all day long, and then the next day introduce herself to them again as if, like, not knowing who they were, even though she had worked with them for over 2 years at that point and spent the previous day screaming at them via email. So not knowing someone's name was clearly meant to emphasize, I don't need to know your name. I mean, that's what it felt like to a lot of those people. And then the electoral component of that was during his race against his primary challenge from Zephyr Teachout, which came in 2014. Zephyr Teachout was a law professor who primaried Andrew Cuomo from the left. Excuse me. And he made a point of never referring to her by name the entire time that she ran against him in a Democratic primary, the gubernatorial race in 2014 in New York State. And he never gave her the acknowledgement. And that is clearly a power move. He's trying to beat her. By the way, she won a healthy 34% of the vote against him. She was not she was a real candidate, a real challenger. But she approached him one day at a parade, and there were cameras on her, and you can see the video of it. He wouldn't meet her eye or shake her hand. So that puts all of these questions as like, how do you refer to people? Do you use their names? Using people's names is a sign of acknowledging them, respecting them, treating them as your peers and your coworkers and your colleagues and the people you're working with, presumably to make the state better and to do your job. If what you're more interested in telegraphing is that they're not worthy of being called by their names, then what you're doing is power hoarding. You're not actually governing.
Anna, do you want to add to that about your experience?
Yes. The governor never used my name once. I was on the receiving end of some nasty emails from Melissa. She never said my name. There was another woman that Rebecca interviewed in her piece that said she had an interaction with Melissa in like the ladies' restroom, and she said she looked at her and she never felt like less of a human being. And that really spoke to me because I just felt, She made me feel like I was an absolute just piece of furniture. So that's all accurate.
And that also has an end if you are abusing power. In part, you're reliant on the idea that the people you're abusing aren't ever going to challenge you on it, right? And part of how you convey to them that there's no point in them ever challenging is to make sure they feel that they are pieces of furniture, to use Anna's words there, right? So many people across context, people who work for Cuomo, people who worked in the legislature, something that Yulene Ngo, who is a state legislator, told me that was heartbreaking, was that the message that is sent to people on the margins, people with less power, by those who abuse their power, is that they're nothing. They're, as Anna says, not even human. That they're made to feel inconsequential. And that is part of the process that discourages them from ever coming forward and telling the stories of the abuse that they experienced, because what gets embedded in them is a sense that it won't matter, that they don't matter enough to ever come out and tell a story about what they experienced working in the executive chamber. And so make no mistake, the diminution that power move of not acknowledging a person's name is meant to disempower them further, to make them less of a challenge to you.
Well, let me just read one little bit of feedback here. Benjamin says, Evan, thanks for this. It is absolutely possible to be a strong leader without yelling and cursing. Having managed over 100 people, the thing I cherish most is when the people that were on my team call me years later and thank me for how I managed. As far as the sexual harassment that Cuomo is alleged to have done, it is abhorrent, but he still deserves time for the facts to come out. And if guilty, he also deserves all that he receives next. That is from Benjamin. I will also say, looking at some of the feedback, there has been a heartening surge of support for analysts and many of the women telling their stories. There is also this very predictable response to seemingly any woman who levels an accusation against a political figure. Someone inevitably says, well, the timing of this seems off. I mean, Anna, how often have you dealt with people making this idea that, well, what's the time? What is this about? What is the timing? As if there's ever a safe or a good time to put yourself out there like this?
Ever since the first day that I spoke up, when the Wall Street Journal piece was published, I've been getting a string of, you know, direct messages or tweets directed at me, speculating about the timing and speculating that myself and the other women are being paid off by Donald Trump or, you know, some version of that story, which is absurd.
Yeah. And you know, Rebecca, why do you think that's the default defense of Brett Kavanaugh, Andrew Cuomo, even Congressman Tom Reed, who there was this whiplash of Tom Reed gets, his supporters said that the woman who was alleging that he had groped her essentially at a restaurant when he was drinking and was out to dinner with people a few years ago, tried to unhook her bra in a restaurant, and she was texting friends and was horrified. Some of Tom Reed's supporters were already telling reporters, well, what's the timing of this? This seems off. The next day, Tom Reed essentially confirms it's true and he's not running again. But he also had people saying on his behalf, what's the timing of this? Why is that the default?
Well, because people who want to offer up a defense are going to find a defense. And when you're talking about powerful people, A, almost any time that stories finally emerge and people, and not only emerge, but that people start to care about them, which is a critical difference, right? Because, you know, Lindsay Boylan first talked about this in December, and it's not as though it cracked open then, right? What is the timing? The timing usually has more to do with when there's a window in which people will care about these kind of abuses. Mm. Remember that so much of what Cuomo has done has been open, right? He's had a reputation for years as a bully. He has done things in front of the Albany Press Corps and to the Albany Press Corps that have been on record. The video of him saying to the female reporter, and I hasten to say that she herself has said, oh, I don't think of that as harassment, so I'm not trying to, but there's a video of him saying to a female reporter, like, you know, eat the whole sausage, making sort of a joke, a sausage joke that's professionally inappropriate on camera. A lot of this stuff, it's not a question, the timing question isn't, are these stories just coming out now? The timing question is, why do we care now? Why do people care? Why are newspapers, lots of places that have observed this, known about it for years, are writing about it now? And that is the answer to why now is a very complicated question. I think in Cuomo's case, and it's different for each one of these guys you're mentioning, in Cuomo's case, again, I don't think it's as much about Cuomo or anything about his particular trajectory right now as it is about the fact that there was an opening after the Attorney General's report on the nursing homes. He was weakened for a moment because so much of this has felt daunting. If you were a person who had these experiences with Andrew Cuomo, and yet Andrew Cuomo is coasting high and everybody loves him and is calling him, you know, calling themselves Cuomosexuals, the idea that you're going to come out and tell your story about what you experienced working for him and how it's at odds with the public perception of him, it's incredibly daunting, the notion that you could tell that story and have it resonate in any way. But at a moment where that impenetrability begins to fade, where there's a report from the Attorney General on a cover-up, reporting that shows that there was bad governance, that, you know, alleges that there was bad governance, deception, and then you had Ron Kim in that moment, the state legislator tell his story of how Cuomo called him at home and threatened him. And that resonated enough that The View, off, you know, a national television program, offered Ron Kim a place to tell his story to a broad audience. And that clearly took hold. And then it opened a window in which other people could tell their stories. But that is not, if stories are being told about a powerful person, then according to that person's defenders, the timing is always going to be off because that person is by definition powerful, right? And so there's always going to be a ready defense, which is you're just trying to bring this person down now, right? And what we hear in that, I think we all should think about timing. I think we should all ask ourselves these questions about why now and then think about why hasn't it mattered before?
Rebecca Traister, I want to thank you for making time. Rebecca Traister is a journalist and an author whose work includes Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger, and her recent piece for New York Magazine was titled Abuse and Power. Thank you, Rebecca. I appreciate the work that you do, and it's really an honor to have you on this program. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me. And also, I just want to say, I've said this to Anna directly, that I am really grateful to the women, including Anna, who are willing to tell their stories of their experiences with such specificity, because it has absolutely been crucial to this necessary process of opening a window and more people coming and telling the truth about their experiences within this administration and with this governor.
Thank you, Rebecca. I look forward to the next. Rebecca Traister joining us, and you'll find her work on a number of platforms. Anna Liss also with us this hour. She is the Director of Planning and Development for Monroe County, who has been telling her story of working for the Cuomo administration. And I just want to wrap the hour talking about what comes next here, because the public has been seeing that there is a probe being led by the Attorney General, Tish James. There is also a separate probe that Carl Hastie from the New York State Assembly is helping lead. And there is some real question about whether those are of equal value and legitimacy. Anna, how do you see those?
Well, Hastie announced recently that the law firm Davis Polk and Wardell was hired to lead the Assembly's investigation into impeachment. And there are concerns amongst myself, Lindsay expressed them publicly, Lindsay Boylan on Twitter, and other people that this is a conflict of interest because the chief judge, so the Court of Appeals, chief judge is Janet DeFiore, and she's married to a man named Dennis Glaser, who previously worked for that firm that the Assembly retained, and Ms. DeFiore was nominated to that position by the governor. So there's very strong political connections here. Mr. Hastie indicated recently that this investigation was going to take a really long time, several months. And I will say that I've actively cooperated in the Attorney General's office investigation. I spent several hours on the phone with that legal team. And the results of Attorney General James's parallel investigation into the sexual harassment allegations is going to be factored into the Judiciary Committee's investigation, meaning that investigation won't conclude until after the AG probe concludes. So effectively, by participating in the Attorney General's office probe, speaking to those independent attorneys, I am participating in the impeachment probe. However, we are concerned about those nefarious ties and what that might mean.
Just putting it in plain language, do you feel that it's possibly rigged is a strong word, but overly influenced by personal connection? Is that correct?
Yes, it's overly influenced by personal connection on the part of the governor, which is not unusual. This has been the case in other instances. Several years ago, once the J. Cope investigation started looking into the governor himself, he completely dismantled that effort. So this is par for the course, I would say.
You're talking about the Moreland Commission, is that right?
Yeah, yes, the Moreland Commission investigation.
And if listeners, I think that goes back to 2014.
I was there. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the New York Times had broken the story that, there was this Moreland Commission that was supposed to be taking a look at ethics. And when it got too close to the governor, he said, that's enough of that. I'm overly summarizing, but is that a fair summary?
Yeah, I was there when it happened, so I can speak to the fact that once some inquiries started coming to us in the executive chamber, the lawyers in the counsel's office ran around and basically told us all I remember them making certain advising us on emails and how we should be careful in certain actions and behaviors. And subsequent to that, immediately the Moreland Commission was dismantled.
Yeah. So what are you hopeful will happen? I assume starting with the AG's probe here. I mean, what are your expectations? What are your hopes for that?
I hope that so my story, as I've mentioned, is not an R-rated story, whereas Lindsay's story, the other young woman that came forward who said he groped her and there was a police report filed, another young woman made other explicit comments about him and his actions towards her. I believe that as long as those women can provide contemporaneous evidence to their claims, which I believe they have, Charlotte Bennett submitted 120 some odd pages of evidence to the Attorney General's office. I believe that this will conclude with the governor being found guilty, because I know that he is guilty because I am telling the truth and I know what I saw and what I heard when I was there. And we've just all been afraid for so many years. And it's great that there may be an opportunity for justice here.
For the Democratic Party, this is someone who has been a significant political figure in a significant political family that goes back decades now. For those who have said, had made any sort of doubts about these stories just based on partisanship, what's your message for other Democrats?
My message is, if you have a daughter or a sister, you know, where's your compassion? Why is it okay for people for men to abuse women if they are Democrats? We all decried Donald Trump when we were talking about the allegations against him, and folks that came out against Trump have come out. Many of them have come out in support of the governor for very similar allegations, and I just think it's hypocritical. We can find the Democratic talent bench is deep in the state of New York. We can certainly find a whole slew of adept and talented individuals who are not abusive, toxic managers.
Nick in Fairport, I'll close the hour with this. Nick in Fairport writes, listening to this show with my 9-year-old daughter, I've been a proud supporter of Governor Cuomo, but I have no tolerance for toxicity. Please let Anna know that I'm so proud of her courage and resilience. She is a role model for our daughters. 30 seconds, Anna. I know you talked about how mentally you're in a very bad place years ago working in Albany. How are you now?
Thanks, Evan. I'm doing great. I still talk to a therapist, and that keeps me honest and it keeps me in good mental health. I work for an amazing boss who looks out for me and the other members of our team. There's no hostility in my workplace anymore. And, you know, I'm married now and I'm happy and, you know, that's not my life anymore.
I am grateful for you taking the time. And I know every time you have to do this, it's not easy. So please know that it is appreciated and valued. And I look forward to the next time we talk when it will be about, I assume, just good old economic development and business. How's that?
I hope so. Thanks, Evan.
You got it. Anna Liss is the Director of Planning and Development for Monroe County. Our thanks as well to journalist Rebecca Traister. And there are more connections coming your way in a moment.